This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Jeremy Corbyn, the UK's popular Labour Party leader, has faced one obstacle after another from both outside and even inside his own party. The long-time staunchly leftist activist shocked many when he came into his leadership position on a strongly anti-austerity, anti-war platform, often compared to Bernie Sanders in the US. Corbyn has managed to hold on to power so far, and many in the UK are hopeful that his leadership will last longer and have more specific consequences than Sanders in the US. Joining me now is Hilary Wainwright. She's a well-known British journalist and writer, founding editor of Red Pepper, a popular left publication. She's also a fellow of the Transnational Institute and senior research associate at the International Center for Participation Studies at the Department of Peace Studies, University of Bradford. And she's been a visiting professor at a number of international universities, including UCLA. And her essay, The Making of Jeremy Corbyn, was just published in a new anthology called Europe in Revolt. Welcome to the program, Hilary.
Hi, welcome. Good to be here, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, how did somebody like Jeremy Corbyn, somebody with his politics, actually make it to not just the top, but the very leadership of the Labour Party? That story in itself, I think, is an important one, right?
Yes, very important. And it was surprising for many of us. You know, I remember having dinner with some friends who were all, you know, all on the left, you know, and hearing that he might be on the ballot or might not. I mean, to explain, maybe this, it's a quite a complex process, the election of a Labour leader. It's been a result of many struggles that have led to changes. I mean, originally, it was a matter of the parliamentary party choosing the leader. And that's important to bear in mind that historically, the Labour Party has been very dominated by what Ralph Miliband, you know, the famous political theorist, called parliamentarism. He opened his book on parliamentary socialism by saying that the Labour Party, I can't remember the exact quote, but it was something to the effect of, is a very dogmatic party, not dogmatic about socialism, but about parliamentarism. And parliamentarism wasn't just about parliament, you know, and recognising the importance of parliament, but it was like a deference to the power of parliament as being the kind of summit of power. The crown in parliament is what MPs, they give their oath to the crown in parliament, which is really the state, rather than to the people. So it's a kind of very sacred institution. So the PLP, as it's called, the Parliamentary Labour Party, has a great sense of its own importance. And it initially was the body that decided on the leader. Now, over the years, particularly in the 70s, there's been a revolt against this. And the franchise has been widened, firstly to include the unions, then to include the membership. But still, the parliamentary party had considerable power. And when Jeremy began his, as it were, journey, the campaign to be leader, it was a matter, it had got back to simply the MPs had 15% sort of role. I mean, they had all candidates had to get 15% of the PLP nominating them. So it was a bit... I mean, that's not a huge amount. It was about 35 MPs, but it was a bit touch and go whether he would get those nominations. So that was the first hurdle. And it's first maybe important to know that the left had been pretty much defeated inside the party, particularly inside the parliamentary party, by Tony Blair and New Labour. So standing from the left in the leadership election was a pretty unrewarding process. And you know, the left MPs sat round a table, only about four of them, and thought, well, somebody needs to stand. Everybody's asking us for a voice for the left. And John McDonnell, who's now shadow chancellor, in effect, you know, one of Jeremy's allies, said, well, I did it last year and I've had a heart attack and I can't do it again. And Diane Abbott, who was, you know, a very feisty black MP, very good campaigning MP, had done it once before, and she said, well, I never get anywhere, I can't do it. And they all looked at Jeremy, and he's a very kind of very nice guy, and he said, okay, well, I guess it's my turn. But he was no way like sort of thrusting, wanting to do it. He was a reluctant candidate. In a way, that's kind of maybe a good thing, because people are wanting a different kind of leadership. They're completely fed up. When I say they, I mean a mass of people. The polls indicate very widespread disillusion. It's indicated also in the numbers of abstentions. People are really disillusioned with the political class. And Jeremy is, in a sense, maybe like Bernie Sanders, a kind of anti-politics politician. He's highly political, but in a way, he made his oath to the people. Well, in fact, he made it, obviously, like all MPs, to the crown, probably with his fingers crossed. But, you know, he day-to-day makes an oath to the people in his practice. He's always giving voice, championing different struggles. So anyway, once he got on, just very quickly to do the explanation, once he got onto the ballot, he was like a sort of lightning rod for all this disillusionment and the sort of pent-up anger built up since Thatcher destroyed industry, destroyed the unions. And then there'd been a rule change which enabled individual members of unions to vote rather than it being done through a bloc which was in the power of the leadership. And again, that gave a voice to the angry rank and file. And so, in a way, it became a completely unexpected campaign. You know, young people were climbing into the windows of his meetings. It just gathered momentum. And so he won. But it was on the basis of this sort of wave of discontent, of indignation, as people say, that is evident in different forms in different countries. You know, it's evident in the squares of Spain, in the squares of Greece, in the primary elections in the United States, and in Britain, it's been expressed through the Labour Party.
And just to clarify, just to clarify also to our American audience, Jeremy Corbyn essentially won the leadership of the Labour Party. And the Labour Party has a similar reputation to the Democratic Party in the US, where it has stated values of populism, of liberalism, and however, in the end, ends up being in the service of business interests, corporate interests, and being pro-austerity. And so the internal left wing of the Labour Party, like the internal left wing of the Democratic Party, has been trying for years to actually have those values come in line with policies. Now, what sort of opposition has Jeremy Corbyn faced, not just from outside the party, but even from inside the party?
Well, I think that goes back to the point I was making about the Parliamentary Labour Party, because that's where the opposition is coming from. I mean, his support is amongst members and amongst supporters of the Labour Party, some of whom aren't members, but who support it. So it's a bit like a primary. But you know, the Parliamentary Party, they feel they have the prerogative, a bit like managers, you know, standby managerial prerogative. The PLP cannot believe that their prerogative to decide the leader, to decide the future of the party, to really be in charge, you know, could be challenged. So they, from the beginning, combined with the New Labour hatred of the left, you know, in a way, it's a bit like somebody trying to get rid of rats in their house. The New Labour people were trying to, as it were, hired rent-a-kill or employed their own tactics to get rid of the left. And then, as it were, a rat kind of starts actually dominating the house, you know, and that's unbelievable. So they were like, it was like a nightmare to them. So after Jeremy won, there was, in a sense, a set determination to catch him out, to get rid of him. So he faced opposition right from the beginning. He was never really given a fair chance. I mean, which is, it's ironic, because the unity has been such an important theme in the Labour Party. You know, it's almost transferred from the industrial context, where a strike, unity is all. Similarly, in the Labour Party, you know, the left often abandoned its protests in the build-up to an election in order to be united in facing the Tories. the right and the people opposing Jeremy, the leadership of the Parliamentary Labour Party, had no compunction but to oppose him. And then finally, after the vote in the European, the referendum around Europe, after that vote went against Remain, which was the Labour Party's position, and Jeremy's position was...
This is on the Brexit vote.
Sorry?
This is on the Brexit vote, yeah.
The Brexit vote, yes. So then they really turned on him and blamed him for that. And then they started resigning and put pressures on others to resign. So now he's got a group of about 40 MPs. He's rebuilt the shadow cabinet, but he's got the huge majority of members, you know, who after all, in the end, the Labour Party depends on members to win elections, to campaign, to canvass, to bring people to vote, to persuade people to vote. So, I mean, you can't become an MP without the members. So, but the parliamentary party is sort of blind somehow to the members.
And so, of course, many within the party who would like to keep the status quo would, are not happy with his energizing of the Labour Party's base, I understand. There's been some bizarre allegations about racism and anti-Semitism. But Jeremy Corbyn, who's on the left, who's had very strong positions of being anti-war, of being pro-refugee, what do these, where do these allegations come from, and are the public buying it?
I don't think the public are buying it. I mean, the polls are not good for Labour, but my analysis is that they're not good. You know, they've fallen well behind the Conservatives, but that's because people vote against a disunited party. So it's the disunity that has caused the low popularity, not all these accusations or disillusionment with Jeremy. I mean, the anti-Semitism thing began with some unfortunate remark by Ken Livingstone about the Jews. I mean, it wasn't anti-Semitic, but it wasn't well chosen, and Jeremy ticked him off, and he's now been expelled from the party. But and no way is Jeremy anti-Semitic, and there's been a commission which has definitely cleared him and cleared the Labour Party. I mean, there's a sort of an element of Israel and sort of Zionists using Jeremy's pro-Palestinian politics to kind of build up an accusation of anti-Semitism.
Right, we're very familiar with that methodology here in the US as well. So, so let's talk about the impact of Corbyn's leadership, broadly speaking. In your essay in the book Europe in Revolt, you begin by comparing him to Alexis Tsipras, the Greek prime minister who just a year ago energized and excited many the world over. And then we saw, of course, sadly, how the Syriza party that he helped to found, what direction it went into here in the U.S. Many Bernie Sanders supporters have been hugely disappointed. Do those cases, are they a warning for Corbyn and also a warning for the left, broadly speaking, that getting involved in electoral politics to try to use electoral politics to make change from the inside can be extremely difficult and possibly impossible?
Yes, I think that certainly lessons have to be learned. I mean, I think my comparison was a little bit around the fact, although you talk about Jeremy being in power, in fact, like Tsipras, who wasn't in power, he was in office in the Greek state. You know, the power lay with the European Union and the IMF. And similarly, Jeremy is in power, is in office, in the leadership office in the Labour Party, but he's not in power. He doesn't have power over the Labour Party. That's still in the hands of the parliamentary party and the old apparatus. So he does face a problem. And I think the lesson from Greece is that, in a way, the Syriza leadership, who haven't lost their sort of radical intentions, but strategically, they put too much faith in the European Union. They really thought the European Union would take seriously the electoral mandate they had when they came to office. But as Varoufakis has made very clear, Schäuble, you know, the German Chancellor, and probably other EU negotiators, for them, you know, elections were up, and I think Schäuble absolutely said it, electoral considerations do not overcome economics. So economics is all, you know, and maintaining a market economy, maintaining a capitalist economy, meeting the deficit requirements and so on. All those are the prime sort of objectives of the EU, and democracy really is a very low priority. And so that was Tsipras's problem. And, you know, some people say that he should have done more to build on Syriza's relationship with social movements, particularly the solidarity initiatives that were like trying to build an alternative economy. And in a way, I mean, I agree with that. I think it's necessary if you are going, you need to be in and against the state and in and against the market. So you need to engage, but you need to be always building autonomous sources of power. So it's never either or. For me, it's never either electoral or social movement. You need both. I mean, social movements in all these countries have in the end sought some electoral expression because they need, you know, they need regimes of austerity to end. They need legislation condoning evictions to end. They need political action, but they need their own sources of power. They can't rely on the state to do their bidding. So those MPs, those parliamentary representatives need to be backed, not just by protest movements, but by real economic initiatives and sources of counterpower.
And then so finally, Hillary does Corbyn and the left wing of the Labour Party have that social base in the public?
I think it's building it. I mean, they've created this movement momentum to try and consolidate the support that he had outside the party and amongst new party members. And that movement, I mean, there's one in Hackney where I live. And we, you know, we put as much of our time into supporting doctors fighting privatization and cuts in the health service, teachers fighting privatization of the health service, tenants fighting the selling off of council housing. We bring them to our meetings, discuss how we can help them. And we build as much support for them as we do put energy into changing the Labour Party. So it's got to be that sort of dual strategy.
Well, Hillary Wainwright, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck to you.
Well, thanks, Sonali. I've enjoyed your questions.
Hillary Wainwright is a well-known British journalist and writer. She's a founding editor of Red Pepper, a popular left publication. And we've been talking about her essay, The Making of Jeremy Corbyn, that was just published in a new anthology called Europe in Revolt. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.